17 intelligence agencies, civilian and military, who have all concluded that these espionage attacks, these cyber attacks, come from the highest levels of the Kremlin, she would say at one of the debates. They are designed to influence our election. The charge actually drew more conclusions than the intelligence community had publicly, and Trump deflected by saying there was no proof Russia was behind the theft and leaking of the Podesta emails. In the debate before the intelligence community assessment was released, he said it could have been China or somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds. The subtle but effective dig, anyone could hack into one of Hillary's email systems. Never mind that it was Podesta's personal Gmail account that was compromised, or that there was no reason to think Hillary's private server, the subject of so much controversy in the campaign because of the perception that she hadn't protected top government secrets, had ever been compromised. Long after the Access Hollywood video had flashed in the political pan, the Podesta emails would continue to cook slowly on the back burner. The other thing that kept Kaplan up at night was the sleeping whale. A friend who sailed the ocean had told him that a boat's systems wouldn't detect a whale resting just beneath the surface of the water. It didn't happen often, but a boat could be destroyed without warning if it struck a sleeping whale. Kaplan lived with the fear that an unanticipated email surfaced by WikiLeaks would be his version of a sleeping whale. The steady drumbeat of Podesta emails took a psychic toll on the campaign and distracted from Hillary's ability to deliver her message. We were the bull that was being stabbed repeatedly in the ring and that was dripping blood, said one aide who worked at the Brooklyn headquarters. More important, as Hillary's team picked up in focus group interviews with voters, people conflated the WikiLeaks releases of DNC and Podesta emails with Hillary's State Department email scandal. It had the effect of just keeping emails in people's minds, said one person familiar with the responses. At the same time, Trump would read the contents of the Podesta emails from the stump to hit Hillary. Hillary wrote that the governments of Qatar and Saudi Arabia are providing clandestine financial and logistical support to ISIL, he said at a Charlotte, North Carolina rally in mid-October. Yet in that same year, Bill and Hillary accepted a check from Saudi Arabia. So Hillary thinks they are funding ISIS and still takes their money. And you know their views on gays and you know their views on women. It's hard to measure the exact effect that WikiLeaks had on the outcome of the election. Hillary led Trump by 4.7 points when the Access Hollywood video and first Podesta emails circulated, and by 7 points 10 days later. But she and her team would be convinced that they played a role in preventing her from running away with the presidency. It hurt us more than we realized, said one senior campaign official. Another drip, drip, drip. A thing that turned good narrative days into mixed narrative days. A whole lot of people read those emails or stories about those emails or chyrons about those emails. In that first week of October, DNC chairwoman Donna Brazile became even more worried about the absence of ground forces in major swing states. On a pad from the Ritz-Carlton in Naples, Florida, she scrawled out the top priorities: Michigan, Florida, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina. She tore off the top page and handed it to Adam Parkomenko, who had moved over to the DNC during the summer, and Donnie Fowler, a veteran political operative turned Silicon Valley tech CEO, who had been picked to run the committee's Get Out the Vote effort. She instructed them to call every political hand they could find in those states, determine how bad the situation was, and report back on what they needed in terms of paid canvassers and other troops on the ground. I fear it's too late, she said, but see what we can do, if anything. The order was at odds with Mook's admonition that the DNC should stay out of Brooklyn's way in planning for the battleground states. And it ran counter to the general air of confidence that permeated the campaign's headquarters. One volunteer who phone-banked from Brooklyn several times in October was assigned to make calls to registered Democrats in Florida. The main goal was to make sure these swing state Democrats had received mail-in ballots. But the volunteer was also tasked with asking for whom the voter intended to cast his or her ballot, information that would be relayed to the analytics team. The majority of respondents either said outright that they weren't going to vote for Clinton, or declined to say whom they would support, which surprised the volunteer. After all, these were registered Democrats. More alarming, some of them reported they would vote for Trump. After one session, the volunteer left the phone banking area to mingle with the paid staff on another floor. The energy in the room juxtaposed to the lack of enthusiasm I was hearing on the calls. Campaign staffers seemed so confident, the volunteer said. They were acting like they had this in the bag. Trump had a strategy for the second debate that was sure to refocus the press and the public. He would drag Bill into the discussion of sexual mores. Held on October 9th, just 2 days after the Access Hollywood video surfaced, it was clear the debate would become a forum for lurid allegations. Trump's strategy was to turn the campaign narrative away from his comments and toward Bill Clinton's misconduct. He'd been laying the groundwork for that line of attack for 10 months, previewing his strategy in a December 2015 tweet during the Christmas to New Year's lull. If Hillary thinks she can unleash her husband with his terrible record of women abuse while playing the women's card on me, she's wrong. And in a Fox News appearance in May 2016, he had mused that Bill might bring the Energizer with him if Hillary won the White House. This code name had been bestowed by the Secret Service on Julie Tauber McMahon, a woman who had for years been rumored to be Bill's on-again, off-again mistress. Some Clinton aides had heard about Julie, a 56-year-old blonde, toned divorcee who also resided in Chappaqua, in his post-White House years. They would often ask reporters what, if anything, they knew about McMahon, shaking their heads that another Bill entanglement could rear its ugly head as the other Clinton entered the presidential race. And they discussed the possibility of a damaging new scandal internally over the course of the campaign. Who is the Energizer who has been Clinton's secret lover? The subject line of one email from Cheryl Mills to John Podesta read. Podesta instructed his assistant to schedule a conference call for him with Mills and Bill's chief of staff, Tina Flournoy. Julie came up again in another email from Podesta. Saw her pic in this or last week's Inquirer, he wrote. Probably need to revisit our Whitehaven conversation. Mills replied back, K, short for okay. The infidelities would dog Bill and his wife's campaign, even if the Republican Party had already concluded that bringing them up wasn't a compelling attack. The Republican National Committee had surveyed voters in 2015 to find out how effective it would be to hit Hillary on her treatment of women who had accused her husband of misconduct. The answer? Not very. GOP officials decided that television talking heads could safely portray Hillary as Bill's enabler to deflect attacks on Trump's womanizing. But, as one party operative put it, as a persuasive argument, it really wasn't there. Trump proceeded to buck his party on the issue, finding it a necessary part of his narrative against the Clintons. At the very least, it could be used to distract from other campaign missteps or knock the Clintons off stride. The media couldn't resist a story about Bill Clinton and sex. The battle lines were drawn, as Trump and Hillary arrived at Washington University in St. Louis for the town hall-style debate. Raines knew it was his job to get Hillary ready for whatever might be thrown at her. Trump would dismiss his own behavior as locker room talk, as he'd done in the press, then move on to describe himself as the candidate who could protect women from predators. Hillary, he'd argue, couldn't be that candidate because she'd attacked Bill's accusers over the years. As he played Trump, Raines made sure to drop in the word rape in reference to Bill. It wasn't pleasant, it wasn't couth, and surprisingly, it wasn't jarring to Hillary. Practice exchanges on the topic were saved for the end of prep sessions because Hillary's aides naturally feared that they could blow up the entire process. If that was going to happen, better it be after they had gotten some work done on other issues. It wasn't like Hillary was hearing that her husband was a predator for the first time. He'd been impeached for his affair with an intern. He'd been sued. He'd lost his law license, and she'd defended him, or at least stood by him. Trump had even been pointing a finger at her for months. But still, reading a tweet was a lot different from being accused face-to-face in the middle of a presidential debate. You're really getting her used to discomfort, or just the sting of it, which is no different than the rest of the debate prep, said one person who was present for the sessions. Despite all that, no one could have predicted the way Trump would try to hijack the second presidential debate. Bill Clinton was getting ready to leave his hotel when he found out that Trump had set up a video event with four women who had accused the former president of a litany of sexual improprieties ranging up to rape. He was livid, unsure how to react. This was beneath the dignity of the office that Trump sought, but it wasn't like Bill to back down from a fight. His team and Hillary's quickly conferred about whether he should stay away from the debate altogether. But that idea was swiftly scuttled, because it would have added fuel to the story. Bill didn't want to do that. "I'm not going to play this game with them," he told one aide. "I'm not going to get bogged down in this." At the same time, in a backstage green room at Washington University, Dunn, Klain, Podesta, Palmieri, and Sullivan began to focus on how Hillary should respond to either Trump or the moderators bringing up the four Bill accusers who would be seated in the debate hall. When Hillary arrived, with just a few minutes to spend with her advisors, she cut to the chase. "How do you expect this is going to play in the debate?" she asked. Dunn was the aide designated to give Hillary a final list of points to remember before the start of the debate. "It's a stunt designed to rattle you," Dunn said. "Don't let him get inside your head." A few minutes later, when the two candidates took the stage from opposite wings, Hillary nodded at Trump with a "don't fuck with me" smile plastered on her face. She stopped abruptly before the midpoint of the stage, leaving him to shuffle awkwardly to his mark without a handshake. She had no intention of touching him. A few minutes later, one of the moderators, Anderson Cooper, asked Trump about the video. "It was locker room talk," Trump replied, adding a rare apology to his family and to the American people. "I am not proud of it," he said. During a follow-up from a voter, though, he turned quickly to Bill and Hillary. "Bill Clinton was abusive to women," he charged. "Hillary Clinton attacked those same women and attacked them viciously. Four of them are here tonight." Hillary brushed it off. "He gets to decide what he wants to talk about," she said. "Instead of answering people's questions, talking about our agenda, laying out the plans that we have that we think can make a better life and a better country, that's his choice." During the debate, Trump often lurked behind Hillary on the theater in the round stage, something Raines had practiced in the Doral prep sessions on a town hall set that Obama lent to Hillary. His presence was a physical reminder that he loomed over Hillary's shoulder, just a few paces back in the rearview mirror, in the race for the presidency. By that point, it almost didn't matter what Hillary said. Sure, she won the debate, but all anyone could talk about was Trump's audacious pre-game gimmick. Afterward, her aides didn't know what to say. They were afraid to tell her that she'd won, because they weren't certain that her victory on the debate stage would break through Trump's masterful manipulation of the media. They were trying to sort it all out when Hillary arrived backstage. "You did a really good job," one of them offered, "but we don't know how it will be perceived." Hillary's aides no longer fully trusted their own political tuners in a campaign season during which Trump had thrown all the traditional rules out the window. It's possible, they thought, that no one would pay attention to Hillary's debate performance. Hillary would go on to win the third and final debate, too. Trump stoked a new controversy by calling her such a nasty woman during it. But she didn't get what she wanted out of what most political insiders thought were three near-flawless performances. In a normal election, such a run of success would be expected to seal the presidency. Instead, Hillary stopped her fall, found her footing, and enjoyed a moderate polling bounce without putting the race away. "These debates had no shelf life to them," one top Hillary aide lamented. "None. Zero." There was another way to look at it. The debates served to reinforce the public perceptions of Hillary and Trump. She was more presidential, totally establishment, and super rehearsed. He embodied change, for good and for ill. He could be genuine while lying. She came off as inauthentic even when she was telling the truth. Hillary had done what she was supposed to do to win, and Trump had blown chance after chance to impersonate a traditional commander-in-chief. In most minds, there was little question after the final debate on October 26th that Hillary was poised to become the next president. But Trump was still lurking, closer to striking distance than even the sharpest election analysts knew. Chapter 19. Comey. In a private moment on the campaign trail, just a few days before the election, Hillary grew reflective about her relationship with the American public. "I know I engender bad reactions from people, and I always have," she confided in an aide who was traveling with her on a swing through several battleground states. "There are some people in whom I bring out the worst. I know that about myself, and I don't know why that is, but it is." "That's going to be one of the main problems you're going to face as president," the aide replied. "Yep," she said, "it is." After suffering 18 months on the trail, vicious campaigns against Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, the oppressive weight of the email scandal, and the pain of being seen as dishonest and corrupt by a large portion of the electorate, Hillary was finally turning a corner, with about 100 hours left before the voting. She could now see the presidency in her hands. She was going to overcome the anger she'd sensed in America, the frustrations she'd had so much trouble putting her finger on. In her heart of hearts, she knew that some of it was less generic, less about the establishment, and more about her personally. But she'd survived it all, she thought. Even an 11th-hour intervention by an old nemesis, FBI Director James Comey. At lunchtime on Friday, October 28th, with early voting still going on in some states and just 11 days until the election, Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz sent a nuclear warhead into the Twitter sphere. "FBI Director just informed me the FBI has learned of the existence of emails that appear to be pertinent to the investigation. Case reopened," Chaffetz tweeted. More precisely, Comey had sent a letter to Congress with that cryptic message, which he would later say was designed to fulfill his pledge to update lawmakers on any new developments regarding Hillary's email. Hillary had just boarded her jet for a flight to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Robbie Mook was making a rare trip with her. With the debates in the rearview mirror, the Podesta emails were threatening a 50,000 cuts end to the campaign. His mission was to push reporters to write about Hillary's stretch-run schedule by discussing why she was going to each place. Jennifer Palmieri and traveling press aide Nick Merrill, both of whom were also on the flight, had remarked to each other that week that things seemed too quiet in the campaign, aside from the soft, dark background music of WikiLeaks. One morsel Mook had to offer as a shiny object for reporters: Hillary was going to visit Arizona, a trip that suggested she was confidently looking to expand the electoral map beyond Democratic-held turf and traditional swing states. But soon reporters would have something much different and much worse for Hillary to write about. Merrill was in the back of the plane with the press when Chris McGarrion of the Los Angeles Times asked whether he had any response to the reopening of the FBI's investigation into Hillary's handling of sensitive emails. "Very funny," Merrill replied, thinking it was a joke. McGarrion assured him that it was not. On a plane with spotty Wi-Fi service, the reporter had seen Chaffetz's tweet. Merrill walked up toward the front of the plane and settled into a space in the back of the front cabin with no seating. He told Mook and Palmieri what was going on. Ever the optimist, Mook wasn't sure it was true. "I don't know, maybe somebody got confused in a game of telephone," he said. "I guess we'll just have to wait for the internet." Merrill tried to get online to confirm the story, and finally got hold of an MSNBC transcript with some of the details. At the time, Hillary was in the front of the plane with childhood friend Betsy Ebeling and celebrity photographer Annie Leibovitz, who had come aboard to take candid pictures of Hillary working and, later, getting off the plane. She was blissfully unaware of the major breaking news that was consuming Washington and the cable news airwaves. Once her aides were sure the story was real, that Comey had, in fact, told Congress that there might be more to the email investigation, they contacted the Brooklyn headquarters and made a plan to discuss strategy once the plane was on the ground. A knot began to form in the pit of Mook's stomach as the plane touched down on the runway. "We've worked so hard and come so close, and of course, this just happened to us," he thought. "What the fuck?" The same feeling had taken hold in Brooklyn, where John Podesta, Jake Sullivan, and Brian Fallon, the National Press Secretary and former Justice Department spokesman, gathered in Podesta's office for the conference call. "This is going to be a Category 5 hurricane," Fallon thought. With the plane coming to a stop, Mook, Palmieri, and Merrill moved to the front to tell Hillary the bad news. Leibovitz was snapping pictures as they told the candidate to hang back for a moment. The task of telling Hillary fell to Palmieri, who had grown close to her during the course of the campaign. The former Obama White House communications director had developed a knack for apprising Hillary of setbacks without getting her worked up. It was one of the reasons Hillary liked having her around, reduced drama, even in a moment when the circumstances may have demanded a more urgent response. "You're not going to believe this," Palmieri said, dispensing the few known details in an "isn't this crazy" tone of voice. Irritated but unsurprised, Hillary rolled her eyes. "Well," she replied, "there's always something." Hillary thought Comey had been way out of line when he'd talked about her case publicly in July, and that this was clearly another instance of him violating Justice Department protocols in the middle of an election. But she had a rally to go to. "When you're on the campaign trail, you've got to compartmentalize," one of her aides later explained. "There's not time to heat up and cool down." On the conference call, Aides in Brooklyn shared what they knew, but it was still hard to ascertain what Comey was talking about. In a letter to relevant congressional committees, he'd written that he had an update on his original testimony on the email case, when he had said the investigation was closed. In connection with an unrelated case, he wrote, the FBI has learned of the existence of emails that appear to be pertinent to the investigation. He added that the Bureau would continue to look into the matter, but noted that he could not yet assess whether or not this material may be significant. He didn't clarify what the other case was or what he thought he had. Never mind that he already had concluded it would be inappropriate to prosecute her over the email, or that the Justice Department had a long-standing policy against taking action just before an election. Comey had done just that, again. Reporters would soon start circulating that Comey was talking about emails found when the FBI seized a computer in connection with investigating Anthony Weiner, who had apparently sent lewd text messages to an underage girl. Huma Abedin, who was traveling with Hillary that day, became increasingly nervous that she might be in the middle of another scandal that could hurt Hillary. She started to rack her brain to figure out whether she'd given her husband a laptop or if he had access to one that was hers. At the same time, Fallon grabbed his phone and started dialing reporters he'd known from his days at the Justice Department. He was hoping to shake loose any tidbits that hadn't yet been reported. Working with little hard information, Hillary's aides in Brooklyn and Cedar Rapids came to one important conclusion. It was next to impossible, if not impossible, for anything new to be in those emails, said one of the aides on the call. No matter what device it was on or what it was, there was no way that it could have been anything new based on what we knew. They believed that any more meat Comey put on the bone would likely be exonerating, but it was dangerous to attack an FBI director without knowing what he might have in his back pocket. Sitting in Podesta's office, Sullivan listened to the rest of the group and then suggested that they publicly push Comey to reveal more. Short of a longer explanation, it would look like there was a serious chance of Hillary being prosecuted after the election. That would hurt her with voters. And indeed, Trump would seize on the vague Comey letter to call Hillary guilty from the stump. Instead of accusing Comey of misconduct or deception immediately, they coalesced around Sullivan's more cautious plan. We held fire because you don't want to say something that isn't the case or is off the mark, the aide said. We all thought that if he's taking this extraordinary step, there must be something we're not understanding. More than 2 hours after the news first broke, they pushed out a statement from Podesta. The director owes it to the American people to immediately provide the full details of what he is now examining, he said. We are confident this will not produce any conclusions different from the one the FBI reached in July. But once again, the words Hillary and email dominated the news. Mook knew that every time one of the candidates had been featured in the news in 2016, that candidate's numbers went down, and he was certain this new revelation would follow the same pattern. Hillary had been separated from the staffers who were planning the response while she went on stage for her rally at the New Bow City Market in Cedar Rapids. When Palmieri slid into Hillary's car for the ride back to the airport, Hillary found out the source of the new email problem. Anthony. At the Republican National Committee headquarters, the celebration was akin to the rebels' reaction to the destruction of the Death Star in the original Star Wars. Think of the command center when you hit the target and everyone cheers, said one person who was there. Regardless of what actually comes of it, it plays to all of her weaknesses. She is constantly buffeted by these allegations based on her conduct and who she had around her. They recognized the news for what it was. Another earth-shifting quake in a spectacularly unsettled campaign. even if Hillary's camp was slow to go into war mode against Comey. But over the course of the next 72 hours, on a series of conference calls, her team would radically reshape their approach to the final days of the campaign. In an effort to close a nasty contest on a high note and set herself up to govern from a more aspirational place, she had planned to spend millions of dollars on positive television ads in battleground states. The reintroduction of her email scandal and its attachment to Wiener meant that she wouldn't be able to concentrate on getting undecided voters to feel good about picking her. They already had deeply held concerns about her character, and this was going to add Clinton fatigue to the mix. Comey had raised the prospect of her facing criminal inquiry from the Oval Office, and the country being plunged back into the nasty, queasy politics of Bill Clinton's final years in office. Instead of just promoting herself on the airwaves, Hillary's aides decided, she would use more of her cash to throw mud on Trump, to try to prevent him from getting a free ride while she again slogged through the email saga. Her end-of-the-race persuasion campaign would be more of a reiteration of the case against Trump. She had to convince voters that he was even worse. When the Comey letter hit, "We definitely amped up the negative," said one aide familiar with the change of direction. It was a major shift in strategy, but one that Hillary's team felt she had no choice but to pursue. She had to try to push voters' focus back to Trump and his shortcomings, not the question of whether she might be in legal jeopardy if she won the White House. "We were able to get her into a place after the email eruptions where people liked her, respected her again. They got into a comfort zone that she was going to be president," said another aide involved in the decision for Hillary to lean more heavily on negative advertising and go after Trump. The Comey thing brought it all back. The resurrection of the email scandal and the go-negative response highlighted the fundamental challenge that the campaign never solved, one that probably couldn't have been solved. "We had trouble moving numbers with a positive message," one of the aides said. There was a silver lining that allowed her to increase her spending across the board. Comey energized her supporters to donate. "We were bringing in more money than we had planned on, and we were shoveling it out the door." As soon as the story broke, Mook had instructed Elon Kriegel, the data master, to increase the number of people the analytics team surveyed each night. He wanted to make sure that any changes in the mood of the electorate could be detected quickly and addressed. Sullivan, a self-confessed bedwetter, had the strongest visceral sense of doom. Suddenly, he believed there was a reasonable chance Hillary would lose the election, and he began pressing Mook and others to abandon efforts to expand the Electoral College map in favor of locking down states that added up to 270. No one in Hillary's camp thought Comey really had new information that could lead to a prosecution, but they knew that perception mattered more than reality in a campaign, especially with so little time to make their case. The peril was compounded by the fact that the FBI had connected Hillary's server investigation to a probe into Wiener's sexting scandal. The tie-in? Some of Abedin's State Department emails had been accessible from the laptop. Hillary was again connected to a politician charged with sexual misconduct. It wasn't her own husband this time, but it was hard to find someone closer to her than Abedin. Huma was such a powerful force within Clinton world that few of her colleagues dared to cross her. But some of them had always viewed her as a major vulnerability, even a national security threat, because of her potential to prevent Hillary from winning the presidency, as one of them put it. She was at the center of the private server controversy. She was being investigated by the Senate for her outside employment while at state. Her husband had repeatedly been drummed out of politics because of his addiction to sexting with strangers. Regardless of her level of culpability, and her defenders say she's unfairly targeted because she's so close to Hillary. Huma was a disaster waiting to happen. In any other political operation, she would have been cast aside publicly and brutally long before this moment. Now her detractors' fears were being realized, and the risk could no longer be ignored. Hillary knew she needed Huma to vanish, but she didn't want to have that conversation with a woman for whom she felt a deep, almost maternal compassion. This was a gut-wrenching time for Hillary, pitting her abiding sense of loyalty, the value she held above all others, against her own self-interest and the fates of the Democratic Party and the nation. Beyond that, there was more than a little chutzpah in Hillary's punishing another woman for a husband's sexual misconduct. Neither banishing Huma nor keeping her at hand was a perfect solution. But one instinct, winning the presidency, clearly outweighed the other. Huma chose to fall on her own sword. Through her lawyer, the same Karen Dunn who had prepared Hillary for the debates, Huma recused herself from further deliberation on the response to Comey and turned her own fate over to the campaign's leadership. If they wanted her off the trail, where she couldn't be photographed next to Hillary, she would accept that judgment. "I'll do whatever," she said, well aware of the maxim that staffers aren't supposed to become the story. "I'll put my situation in your hands." She was pulled off the campaign trail, replaced by longtime Hillary confidant Capricia Marshall and other close allies in the final days of the campaign. The Comey letter was just the biggest of a series of forces outside Hillary's control that were taking a toll on her in the polls. At a rally in Flint, Michigan in early October, Bill Clinton had given voice to the frustrations of working and middle-class voters who saw their health insurance premiums rising in the Obamacare era. "You've got this crazy system where all of a sudden 25 million more people have health care, and then the people who are out there busting it, sometimes 60 hours a week, wind up with their premiums doubled and their coverage cut in half," he'd said. "It's the craziest thing in the world." Bill's words matched up nicely with Republican talking points on the president's signature domestic policy achievement. Of course, he didn't agree with the GOP's repeal and replace mantra. He was a big believer in Obamacare, which looked a lot like the Hillary Care plan from his administration. But he knew how to talk to working class voters. He understood how to speak to their frustrations. Empathy was the trait that had carried him through a lifetime in politics, and his ability to persuade an audience with it was perhaps the most important distinction between his style and his wife's. Both Obama and Hillary had said the law needed fixing, so Bill wasn't exactly freelancing on the idea of change. His language might have been more coarse than theirs, "the craziest thing in the world," but that's exactly the kind of non-Washington speak that appealed to the Bernie and Trump voters who didn't feel a bond with Hillary. Bill sure seemed to know what he was doing. To the campaign, though, his remarks sounded like nails on a chalkboard. Hillary's aides were trying to win the race by rallying the party's base. Taking a swing at Obamacare wasn't an approved method of doing that. When fellow Democrats raised objections, Bill backtracked quickly. He might have been a little sloppy, but he was talking about a more narrow issue within the healthcare system. Some working and middle-class earners who made too much money to qualify for subsidies would see massive premium spikes. That would become much more evident over the course of October, as states and the federal government announced that premiums would rise, often by double and triple-digit percentages for consumers. For example, in Pennsylvania, a state both campaigns saw as a critical stepping stone on the path to 270 electoral votes, people using the popular Silver Plan were facing a 53% increase in premiums. Bill touched a hot stove by taking a swipe at Obamacare, but he grasped the frustration of many key voters. Trump understood the power of the issue, too. Repealing Obamacare and stopping Hillary's health care takeover is one of the single most important reasons that we must win on November 8th, he said at a Florida rally 3 days before the Comey bombshell. Now, with less than 2 weeks left to go, Hillary found herself at the mercy of events, ongoing WikiLeaks releases, the Comey letter, and Obamacare premium increases that she couldn't do much about. And many dissatisfied voters had not yet decided which candidate was the lesser evil. Trump's allies believed, or at least hoped, that voters' indecision would play to his advantage. The one thing that's fascinating this cycle is the volatility in the electorate. They respond to ups and downs like I've never seen before, one senior Republican with ties to the Trump campaign said on October 26th. We have started to trend way back up in key states. If he keeps his fucking mouth shut for the next 12 days, there are a couple of states that are going to surprise you. At the time, Republican officials were eager to share details of their own data-driven operations in advance of the election. Win or lose, they wanted to get credit for having modernized the party after an embarrassing data failure in 2012. Yet when the RNC conducted a briefing for reporters in early November, figures for Pennsylvania and Michigan were withheld because the upticks there were so rosy that party officials didn't believe their own data. They didn't want the projections held against them if, as was widely expected, Trump didn't win those states. The numbers were perceived internally as overly optimistic, and that meant everyone associated with them would look bad, one source said. At the same time, Hillary's team could detect the earth shifting in the wake of the Comey letter. On the ground in swing states, said one campaign official who traveled in the final days of the campaign, you could feel a chilling effect. Before the letter, this aide said, voters were energized. The kind of thing where lines get longer for people waiting to get into events, crowds get bigger, people are more raucous, the aide said. People feel like you might be the person. Comey sucked that energy right out of campaign events. People on the ground felt more nervous about it. It just felt different. In focus groups, consultants heard undecided voters express worry that Hillary would win the presidency and then be the subject of federal investigations throughout her administration. On the macro level, Kriegel and his team could see Trump gaining an edge with a certain kind of voter. For most of the campaign, an unexpectedly high number of voters who should have been with Trump or Clinton, based on their analytics scores, were saying they were undecided or would cast their ballot for a third-party candidate. In mid to late October, much later than normal, they started moving toward their own party's candidate, Republicans to Trump and Democrats to Clinton. Over the last couple of weeks, we saw the strong people were coming home, said one person who had access to the Clinton campaign's analytics. At first, that meant Democratic-leaning voters were picking Clinton and Republican-leaning voters were going with Trump. But that pattern changed. When that Comey letter came out, the source said, Trump people actually sped up with coming home. The people who should have been with Trump but were saying they were going third party were coming home. Ours weren't. Republicans saw the same trend in their data. During the debates, and partially on the strength of the Access Hollywood video, Hillary had been gaining ground. The Comey letter slowed the momentum back down, one GOP source said. In short, the Comey letter made it easier for reluctant Republicans to choose Trump and harder for wary Democrats to sign up with Hillary. Specifically, the Clinton team could see Trump closing ground across the Rust Belt. It was the area that he had targeted, despite conventional wisdom that held the Democratic blue wall would come through for Hillary in the end. Suddenly, Trump's quixotic ride into the heartland looked a lot more strategically sound, and Hillary's attention to expanding the electoral map seemed misguided. Her aides knew the trend lines were bad, and they had no way of making sure their survey data was accurate. The campaign adjusted by dumping millions of dollars into television ads in Michigan and Wisconsin, and by repeatedly dispatching vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine to Wisconsin. "Michigan was trending hard against us," said one mid-level campaign official. "Ohio, in particular after the Comey letter, it was done. Ohio and Michigan aren't that different. Ohio and Pennsylvania aren't that different. Basically, every state in the Midwest did trend toward Trump at the end," the aide said. Kriegel had always looked at Michigan and Pennsylvania as the tipping point states. What that meant was that he could rank order states in terms of their likelihood to go for Clinton or Trump, and those were the two states most likely to indicate which candidate could win 270 or more electoral votes on Election Day. Everyone in Hillary's campaign expected both of them to go in her direction, and that was a big part of the reason she had spent time trying to win states that were a bigger reach. There wasn't any warning at all that the Midwest states were truly in play until the FBI letter, said one campaign official. Those states, the bottom didn't fall out until Comey. Even in the face of declining numbers, Brooklyn felt comfortable that Hillary still had a pad in Michigan and Wisconsin. "We did not believe we were in danger of losing those two states," said one aide involved in strategy discussions. But because of Comey and the slipping margins, Hillary's aides chose to be what the aide called more defensive in the campaign spending, meaning less money for states at the edge of the electoral map and more for those she absolutely needed to win to become president. Still, the campaign's only measure of the head-to-head numbers between Clinton and Trump, the analytics surveys, showed Hillary with a lead in the battleground states. Mook had chosen not to spend money on polling, to the great frustration of some of the campaign's aides and advisors in key states. In Florida, Craig Smith, the former White House political director, and Scott Arsenault, a veteran Southern Democratic political operative, had begged Mook to poll the state in October, to no avail. Mook believed it was a waste of money. He had learned from David Plouffe, Obama's campaign manager, that old-school polling should be used for testing messages and gauging the sentiments of the electorate, and that analytics were just as good for tracking which candidate was ahead and by how much in each state. Plus, the analytics were quicker and much cheaper. In Mook's mind, the two forms were indistinguishable in terms of testing the horse race, and he was worried about overspending, even after the Comey letter produced a windfall of contributions from concerned Democrats. So he declined to use pollsters to track voter preferences in the final 3 weeks of the campaign. Some Clinton aides and advisors thought that was an unwise decision, because it robbed him of another data point against which to check the analytics. "They just cut it too tight to the edge, and that was because of that absolute belief of Elon. And then it was Robbie not wanting to spend money, and it was no checks and balances and transparency in the system," said one person who thought Mook could have done more to understand where Hillary stood in the stretch run. "That's how you end up with realizing it too late." There's no guarantee that Hillary's pollsters would have come up with different numbers, but many officials on the campaign and in the larger Democratic Party believed at the time that Mook relied too much on analytics. Still, it was hard to fight with him because no one wanted to sound like a Luddite in the face of data, and the candidate herself had long since blessed his approach. Even when the numbers tightened following the Comey letter, they showed she still had a substantial edge in enough states to win the presidency comfortably. As had been the case throughout the campaign, Mook based nearly every spending decision and deployment of resources on Kriegel's data. So Hillary never went to Wisconsin, the state where she had been forced to cancel her first planned joint appearance with Obama earlier in the year. Despite a major field operation in the state, her organizers were frustrated that Mook wouldn't provide basic resources like campaign literature so they could try to persuade voters to back Hillary. What is the point of having 100 people on the ground if you're not giving them any of the tools to do the work? Said one veteran Democratic organizer familiar with the Wisconsin operation. That should be part of the plan. The complaint echoed those of campaign leaders across the battleground states. In Michigan, the campaign feared that sending Hillary would actually backfire. We spent a lot more money in terms of field and digital and mail than President Obama ever did, said one person familiar with the decisions. Our strategy was from all the data we saw. Every time there was a mention of the election there, we did worse. To make the election a bigger deal was not good for our prospects in Michigan. So they largely kept the candidate out of the state rather than figuring out how to alter that dynamic. The strategy ran counter to Bill's core belief that a candidate had to show up to sway voters. Hillary did end up making a last-minute visit to Grand Rapids the day before the election, after a lot of pressure from political officials in the state, but more for insurance than out of fear that she would lose there. As she lost ground in the Rust Belt, the discussion among Hillary's aides intensified. They weighed the risk of alerting the media and Trump to her vulnerability by changing her manifest. We could have ripped up events from other places and then tried to throw together an event in the Rust Belt, but then the press would have been like, oh my God, panic, and that would have put bright lights around the state for Trump. None of the complaints were new. Mook and his moneyball approach to politics rankled the old order of political operatives and consultants because it made some of their work obsolete. He had been fighting that battle from the earliest days of the campaign, and he didn't see any reason to change strategies and tactics that appeared to be working. Hillary was poised to win the presidency, and to do it with a little bit of money left in the bank. The efficiencies had helped pull her through the darkest days, and the numbers showed that she was still in control of the race. The analysts felt like they could trust their data, in part because early voting in swing states matched up well with their projections. They didn't think there was any reason to expect that Election Day turnout would vary significantly. The memo that one Hillary advisor had sent months earlier, warning that they should add 3 or 4 points to Trump's poll position, was a distant memory. The early voting numbers in Florida were so good that even Bill Clinton, who had chafed at Brooklyn's tendency to ignore his feel for politics on the ground, excitedly told one campaign aide the Friday before the election that the Sunshine State was in the bag. And Mook and Kriegel were not operating in a total information vacuum outside of the data analytics. Public polling showed Hillary with a clear lead nationally and in enough battleground states to carry the election with room to spare. The New York Times upshot, Nate Silver's 538, and other election prognosticators rated Hillary as the overwhelming favorite, though Silver's projection wasn't quite as rosy. By the time Comey returned to the spotlight 2 days before the election to say he still wouldn't recommend charges against Hillary, it was hard to find serious election analysts who were predicting a Trump victory. Hillary was on her plane when Comey announced there was nothing more to the investigation. Merrill walked to the front where she was sitting with Cheryl Mills. The FBI just put out another letter, Merrill said, and it turns out there was nothing to the first one. Hillary rolled her eyes again. What a surprise, she said sarcastically. But she was in a good mood, generally. We were feeling good about Florida, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, said an aide who was traveling with her. We knew we had taken a hit from Comey, but we didn't think it would be an insurmountable one. It was fun. There was an energy. Everything Hillary was hearing and seeing pointed to a victory. Even Sullivan, the incorrigible pessimist, thought she was going to win in the final days. Nearly a decade after she'd launched her first campaign for the presidency, the glass ceiling was within Hillary's reach, and the hammer of the American electorate was in her grasp. She would finally get the chance to run the country that she loved. In those final days, she believed she was going to win, and she was probably more bearish than most of us, said one senior campaign aide. She was getting comfortable with the idea that it was going to happen. She was thinking a lot about government. But while Hillary was measuring the drapes in the Oval Office, her team was mismeasuring the electorate. Chapter 20. I'm sorry. No, 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 Minion Moore screamed into her phone. Yes, the voice on the other end of the line repeated. She's getting ready to call Trump. It was 2:30 a.m. Moore had stepped away from the election analysts in Hillary's Midtown Manhattan boiler room for this call, and the other aide was inside the Peninsula Hotel, not far from a candidate who was about to concede the presidency to a reality TV star. Well, why the hell are you telling me for if she's getting ready to call? Moore snapped back. She shouldn't do it. If there was anyone who spoke for the heart of Hillary Land, it was Moore. During the darkest days of the primaries, she'd been brought into the campaign, her fourth for the Clintons, because she knew the candidate so well, and because she could apply a steady, veteran hand to a machine being run by outsiders. Now, a bunch of outsiders had determined it was time for Hillary, the first woman ever nominated for the presidency, to give up. She was losing Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. The AP had called the race. President Obama had urged her to end it. And the data-wielding millennials on her own team saw no remaining path to victory. But for Moore and a handful of other true Hillary loyalists, many of whom had lived through Al Gore's too quick concession in 2000, it wasn't time to concede. Not yet. The numbers might flip by morning. It's too murky, Moore insisted. But Hillary was already mid-surrender. Give me the phone. I'm calling him, she'd instructed her aides. It took a few minutes, giving Moore time to register her objections, but Huma Abedin finally connected with Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway. Huma handed the phone to Hillary, who put it to her cheek and uttered two words she'd never expected to hear in her own voice. Congratulations, Donald. Hillary's aides began arriving at a Midtown Manhattan boiler room before sunup on election day. Adisu DeMessi, a double Yale grad who worked on Hillary's states team, had barely had time to shower on his way to the office. At 3 a.m., he'd been at the airport in White Plains, 30 miles north of the city, to greet Hillary's jet after her final rally of the campaign, a midnight affair in Raleigh, North Carolina that featured Bon Jovi. Then he'd hightailed it back to the city. DeMessi would spend the next 22 hours or so in the boiler room, kept company by fellow voter turnout specialists and CNN playing on the lone TV screen in the office's conference room. A team of number crunchers settled into one of several side offices early. By the time consultants Joel Benenson, Jim Margolis, Mandy Grunwald, and John Anzalone trickled in, Hillary was on her way to cast her vote at an elementary school in Chappaqua. Election law specialist Mark Elias set up shop in the Midtown office, as did Minion Moore, Charlie Baker, and Michael Hooley, the Dewey Square Group consultants who had helped Hillary plot her run from the start. DNC chairwoman Donna Brazile and Robbie Mook floated in and out during the day. Mook couldn't shake the feeling that something bad was about to happen. A common fear for campaign managers on election day, but an unsettling one all the same. "We're not allowed to have nice things on this campaign," he thought. "So what's the nice thing that we're not going to be able to have today?" When the first early exit polls came in and hinted that Trump was running a little stronger than expected in the Rust Belt, Mook believed the numbers were still in line with what Hillary would need to take key battleground states. As he made his way around Manhattan that Tuesday, though, his optimism was tempered by that nagging feeling that something, minor or cataclysmic, would go wrong. Hillary's communications team decamped to the Javits Center in the Hell's Kitchen section of Manhattan, where preparations for her victory party were being made. The venue, which would fill with Hillary aides, donors, friends, and well-wishers over the course of the day, was chosen in large part because of its distinctive feature, a glass ceiling. If everything went as planned, it would be the glass ceiling of the presidency that lay shattered under Hillary by the end of the night. A handful of key aides remained in the campaign's Brooklyn headquarters for election night, but the top brass, including Mook, John Podesta, and Cheryl Mills, joined Hillary and Bill Clinton on their floor at the top of the Peninsula Hotel, a five-star facility a block from Trump Tower. The Clintons had their own suite, and the rest of the floor had been rented out for staff workspace and for aides, including Podesta and Abedin, to have private bedrooms. At the start of the night, the Javits Center was electric. It had the buzz of a debut performance on Broadway. Outside, a seemingly endless line formed down 40th Street, near artists who had sketched Hillary's portrait next to Obama's, and vendors who sold buttons with the candidate's name. Supporters, resplendent in their "I'm with her" and "Madam President" t-shirts, filed in and stood shoulder to shoulder as they watched the returns trickle in on the large television monitors overhead. Under the signature glass ceiling lit by an ocean blue hue, they watched the network broadcasts and listened to a string of surrogates from pop star Katy Perry to Senator Chuck Schumer fire up the crowd. Clinton's campaign anthem, Fight Song, blared across the room, and an official block party formed outside for a spillover crowd who held American flags and prepared for victory. A block away, at the historic Hudson Mercantile Building, Hillary fundraising chief Dennis Cheng threw a lavish party for longtime Clinton loyalists. They watched TV and scrolled through their smartphones to check on election results. The plan was for these Clintonites to make their way from the airy event space to the Javits Center as Hillary's victory drew closer. Just before polls closed on the East Coast, Hillary summoned Jake Sullivan, Dan Schwerin, and Megan Rooney to her suite to go over her victory speech. She'd been sent drafts over the previous few days, but hadn't really focused on it until now. When the writers arrived, Bill and Hillary were already in the suite's study. Hillary sat behind a desk, picking over a salad. She had donned a jewel-toned scarf and traded the gold jacket she'd had on earlier in the day for a more comfortable wool jacket. The writers pulled up chairs around the desk while Hillary gave them instructions. She wanted to scrub the speech of anything that could be perceived as critical of Trump and his supporters. She added a mention of children with disabilities to a list of policy issues to which she would call attention. And she beefed up the shout-out section to name-check more friends and supporters. Bill jumped in with a few names of his own. As the group tightened and rearranged her remarks, vote totals started trickling in. When Hillary was satisfied with the text, Bill walked into the living room and laid claim to the couch. He would remain parked there for the rest of the night, watching television and dialing friends across the country. The concession version of Hillary's speech, a grim assignment that had fallen to Rooney several days earlier, remained tucked away, undiscussed. Mook and Jennifer Palmieri had been in a staff room on the same floor watching CNN when polls closed in Virginia and Florida at 7 p.m. As the first returns came in, Mook dashed into the room next door, where Elon Kriegel and a couple of his data analysts compared the results with the campaign's projections. Having guided Terry McAuliffe's gubernatorial campaign in 2013, with Kriegel at his side, Mook knew the nooks and crannies of Virginia precincts as well as anyone in the political universe. "It's okay," he thought. "It isn't great, but it's okay." Then a cluster of African-American majority precincts around Jacksonville, Florida, came in. Those numbers looked strong, robust enough for a few fist pumps around the room. "Florida started coming in fine," one top Hillary aide said. "And then Florida started getting tight." "Fuck you," John Anzalone thought. "You're being too pessimistic." From the boiler room, the veteran pollster and his fellow Clinton campaign consultant Jim Margolis were on the phone with Steve Shale, an old pal from their Obama days. It was 7:45 p.m., and Shale had called to say Hillary was in deep trouble in Florida. No one in the party had a better feel for the state than Shale, a Tallahassee-based operative who had worked on the draft Biden campaign in 2015. "It's in real bad shape," Shale warned his friends. "What the fuck are you talking about?" Anzalone asked. Hillary was on her way to turning out more Sunshine State voters than any previous candidate of either party. Yeah, Trump was winning exurban and rural areas, but surely Democratic hotspots like Miami, Dade, and Broward would erase the deficit. "No," Shale explained, "Trump's numbers weren't just big, they were unreal. In rural Polk County, smack dab in the center of the state, Hillary would collect 3,000 more votes than Obama did in 2012. But Trump would add more than 25,000 votes to Mitt Romney's total. In Pasco County, a swath of suburbs north of Tampa-St. Petersburg, Trump outran Romney by 30,000 votes. Pasco was one of the counties Shale was paying special attention to because the Tampa area tended to attract retirees from the Rust